Everyone, welcome to the week ahead. I'm Tony Nash. Today, we're joined by Joseph Wong, Adam Tumerkin, and Tracy Shuchart. Guys, I'm always flattered when guests of your caliber will come on the show. I'm so grateful that you could be here today. We're covering a few key themes. First is Joseph is going to talk us through a dovish Fed, or as I put, a dovish-ish Fed. That'll be a very interesting discussion. Adam's going to talk us through China's overproduction. Will China drown the world in exports? And we'll talk through some JPY and affordability things as well. And then Tracy's going to talk us through energy markets and how hedge funds are rotating from energy stocks into oil. And we're looking at a few other things there as well. So guys, thank you always. Thank you for, you've all been here before. And I'm so grateful, as I said, that people of your level of intelligence and experience and capability come on. Hi, everyone. We've introduced new subscription tiers for CI Markets. More data, more insights, and more options. CI Markets uses the power of AI to help you make better trading and investment decisions. It's a perfect addition to your analysis toolbox. CI Markets Free is our first tier. It's absolutely free. No strings attached, and it does not require any credit card information. Next, we have offerings at $7.95, $14.95, and $24.95 per month. Each of these offerings includes different forecast assets for stocks, ETFs, commodities, and currencies. Go to CompleteIntel.com to find out more and subscribe. Hope you'll join us soon. Joseph, we've seen a whipsaw in opinion about the Fed policy over the past few months. I think we peaked out at six, seven rate cuts for the year or something. And we're bordering on kind of zero, and people are even now saying maybe a rise or maybe one after the election or something like that. So it's kind of hard to keep up, but kind of not, because there's so much, so many Fed speakers out there that it just changes daily, right? So earlier this week, you sent out a tweet saying that the market viewed the Fed as too hawkish on policy. Can you walk us through that? Because we've all been on this journey over the last 3 months as we went from six or seven to one to zero to a rise. Can you walk us through why you think the market is being too hawkish on policy?
Sure. First of all, thanks for inviting me. It's great to be here. I watch your show and I always learn something from it. So I'm looking forward to hearing what all the other speakers have to say. So Tony, as you correctly note, the market has really been somewhat schizophrenic when it comes to Fed pricing. I think earlier in the year, as you suggested, we were pricing in as many as seven cuts this year. Right now, it looks like, well, maybe one and a half cuts. So there's definitely been a lot of volatility in what the market is pricing. Now, the big shift towards from seven cuts to where we are today seems to be driven by a couple things. Over the past few months, we've had inflation data that has been stronger than expected. It seems like inflation is stickier than the market had expected. Secondly, economic data continues to be very strong. When you're looking at employment data, for example, we created, say, 300,000 jobs last month. Retail sales are strong. And so the market is beginning to think that, well, with the economy is doing so well, why does the Fed have to cut rates? Now, the second thing that happened is that this past week, Chair Powell, he had his little get together in Washington with Governor Tiff Macklem of the Bank of Canada, and they were talking about a wide range of topics. Now, Chair Powell made a point to send a hawkish message. He was saying that inflation has been slower, progress on inflation has been slower than he expected. So basically, he's not in a hurry to cut rates. And this was echoed by the junior people on the committee. Now, as you rightly know, there's a lot of Fed speakers. So when you listen to them, you really got to prioritize. Most of them actually aren't that important. They can be ignored. But Chair Powell, you got to listen to him. President of the New York Fed, John Williams, you got to listen to him. And so the market now, I think, is making the opposite mistake as it did earlier in the year in January. Now, one and a half cuts this year, I find that to be not, that's a bit too hawkish. So the way that I think about this is that the market is misunderstanding the Fed's reaction function when it comes to strong economic data. So let's say we rewind a couple of years ago, inflation was high. The Fed wanted to basically cause a recession to get inflation under control. From the Fed's thinking was, you know, our tools work on the demand side. So if we have inflation, demand pushing against supply, easy. We just raise interest rates, watch economic growth go lower, watch unemployment rate go higher, basically cause a recession. And then voila, we can have inflation back target. Now they did raise rates, but that just didn't play out. The economy continued to be strong. And it seems like there's more and more people at the Fed coming to the conclusion, and Chair Powell included, that the reason why inflation has come down and economic growth has come is strong is not so much that we have an overheated economy that requires ever higher interest rates, is that we had increases in supply. So what's been happening is that it seems because we had millions of people enter the country last year, that's increasing the ability of the economy to produce more goods and services, right? So you basically, you have more people working, so you can have more growth. And at the same time, you can have more jobs created and you can have wages decline. And so that seems to be doing a lot of the work on the disinflation side. So I think the interpretation of strong economic data with, you know, hawkish Fed, that's not right anymore, because strong economic data seems to be due to the supply, increases in supply. And you hear people like John Williams emphasize that. Now, the next thing that I would note is that a lot of people have been focusing on CPI being hotter than expected. Let's say it looks like CPI is stuck at, let's say, 3.5, something like that over the past few months. But that's not the Fed's target. The Fed's target is PCE. Now, PCE and CPI, both measures of consumer inflation, but PCE is structurally lower than CPI. There's kind of a wedge between the two. That wedge is actually slightly higher than it is historically now. PCE right now, year over year, about 2.6%. Think about it from the Fed's perspective. My inflation target is 2. My inflation rate is 2.6. Where should rates be? 5.5 seems quite high from their perspective, especially since that they think that they are being the most restrictive they've been in decades. So it would make sense for them to adjust a little bit. So I still think that we still have about 3 cuts this year. June is probably off the table, but we can start afterwards.
Joseph, one of the things I've asked people about from time to time is kind of the normalization of rates, because a ZIRP environment really isn't sustainable, because there's no real cost of capital, then there's no real, you know, interest doesn't exist. So are we kind of, is it possible that we are at a kind of a new normal in rates? Is it sustainable to stay at 5% in a rate environment and consider that a new normal? Because what that might, what inflation does and what rates do through different levers is they pull some consumption forward, right? And so, I mean, you can take a different view on each one and for different reasons or whatever. But having a cost to capital is a normal part of markets. So is there a belief in the Fed that we should actually have a positive interest rate, or is ZIRP kind of the target? Does the market believe that ZIRP is where we should be? And is that kind of the mindset target of the Fed?
So just looking first at the market, so when you look at short-term interest rate futures, the market is coming along to the conclusion that ZIRP is a thing of the past. When you look at short-term interest rate futures, they're pricing in, let's say, the neutral rates or the longer-term Fed funds rate somewhere around 4% now. Now, it is volatile. So they definitely don't think that Fed is going to go back to 0%. And really, if you look at it historically, what we saw after the great financial crisis, that was kind of an anomaly. Over the past hundreds of years, you know, interest rates are not supposed to be at zero. So I would look at that period as more of an aberration, and the market does as well. Now, within the Fed, you know, I think that's a harder thing to say. There are so many people there. But the way that I would interpret this is to look at the dot plot, where Fed officials basically go and they indicate to the market where they think the long-run Fed funds rate should be. Now, that has been very, very, very slightly ticking up a little bit. The median now is about 2.5%, which is much lower than the market. But you can also see that distribution-wise, it's ticking up ever so slightly, maybe to 2.6. So the Fed is always the last to know. Now, so I don't think that they're, based on the dot plot, that they think that we're going back to ZERP either.
So I almost feel, and this is kind of way out there, so just bear with me, but ZERP and NERP almost have, on some level, been seen as a solution to demographic issues. If you look at Europe and you look at Japan, zero or negative interest rate has been a way to make up for productivity losses as people retire, as people get older, as, you know, this sort of thing. And it almost feels to me like that ZERP environment was a way for the US to bridge the gap between boomers and millennials. And if you look at Japan, I feel like this is why Japan is trapped at ZERP or NERP, because, and Korea is there soon. If they're not there, China will be there very soon. So is it my hypothesis about zero or negative interest rates being a way to a cheat code, I guess, for demographics? Is that real, or is that kind of a way off kind of view of the world?
Well, there are definitely people who think that, you know, aging demographics is disinflationary, argues for very low interest rates. But there's another school of thought as well. So, for example, Charles Goodhart of the formerly of the London School of Economics, he would have a very interesting argument where he would say aging demographics actually means that interest rates need to go higher. Now, why is this the case? So as the population ages, people retire and there's less of a supply in labor, right? Let's say, imagine you are in the US today, 50% of the people suddenly retire tomorrow. Okay, well, who's going to do all the work? Who's going to clean the streets? Who's going to cook up the meals? Who's going to drive the cruise ships all the boomers are going to go on, right? So in that case, what happens is that the labor, price of labor goes up, and also the amount of goods and services the economy is able to produce also declines, right? Because you have fewer people working. Now, in order to maintain inflation, you'd have to increase your real interest rates to prevent people from spending money today, and so that you can distribute the goods and services, which are fewer now, to the people who want them. So in that case, in order to, you know, as you wages go higher, as prices of everything go higher, if you want to target inflation, you'd have to keep interest rates higher. So that's another vision of the world. You know, it's hard to know which vision plays out. I think one of the interesting things that we saw during the pandemic was, well, you did have this sudden supply shock, negative supply shock of labor, where you had a lot of boomers suddenly retire. I think the estimate is that 2 million more boomers retired than had been projected pre-pandemic. That really did seem to drive up wages and have some upward pressure on inflation. But again, the jury's still out. So we can definitely, we've never been in this demographic situation before throughout history, right? The population, people have big families, people continue to grow, population grows. That all changed in the 1980s. So we actually have a shrinking population, or at least the workforce population. In the US is not growing as well much. In China, it's going to be shrinking. In Europe, it's going to be shrinking as well. So it's definitely something that's going to be very, very interesting to see.
Adam, what's your thought on that? Demographics and interest rates.
I think Joseph brings up great points on that. And it reminds me, there was a good book I read, 10 years ago. It was called The Great Wave.
Of course
Wave.
There is.
No, I mean, but it ties to exactly what he was saying, actually. It's called The Great Wave by David Hackett Fisher, the historian. And he goes back and looks at price cycles since 1100 AD. And he found that there were periods back then, it was very like supply constrained. We didn't have the Industrial Revolution back then. So, you know, a crop failure could send grain prices through the roof. Also times of peace, there'd be more you know, men weren't dying. They were having more children at a younger time, so more mouths to feed. So you had demand pull inflation for more mouths to feed, supply cost push inflation, that just from diminished supplies of a crop failure, et cetera. And then there was the monetary inflation, where the not central banks, but the monarchs back then, you know, when they sent Columbus to America and they just took all the silver that entered the system back in Europe, or, you know, et cetera. And one thing I found that was interesting, that there were three big pivotal points. And the first one was the Black Death, the great, you know, the Black Plague. And it wiped out a massive amount of the world's population. And they saw like 50 years of deflation. It was like 50, 60 years of deflation. Even yet labor wages were rising for, you know, farm hands and et cetera, because there was just not enough supply of labor that the, you know, landowners had to overbid them up, essentially. And it still didn't create any inflation, because even though they were getting paid more in, I guess, in real terms back then, the offset of the actual demand from, you know, 50-60% of the population, some areas being wiped out, it over, you know, compensated those losses. So I would say, going forward, I'm curious if the demand from the youth will offset what the older spend. And I think Joseph brought up good points, though. I mean, if there's a lot of equity that's been made in household wealth, if the retirees cash out and they want to go on these cruises, that would be, you know, that you would be demand until healthcare costs kick in, and usually in the 80s. But the other thing is that I'm worried about is, if the boomers are retiring, for someone to sell, if they want to get out of these positions, liquidate their portfolios, take out income, et cetera, they have to sell to someone. So if someone's selling at $1 million, that means someone else has to buy at $1 million. So if a younger person is buying that at $1 million, he now has $1 million less to consume, but now the retiree does. So I guess it would just have to depend where that money would go. And I was actually going to ask Joseph a question earlier when he was talking about the Fed. I was curious on his take, if you think with the US, I think debt to GDP came in over 6% last year, 2023, and it was one of the, I think it was the highest one outside of a recession, out of recession or wartime in the last like 60 years, I was reading. I was curious if you think that stimulated growth on the US side.
Yeah, that absolutely. So, you know, the government is different from you and I, in that when it spends, it can actually just pay for it by issuing debt, right? So if I give you a US Treasury security, that's basically giving you dollars, right? So when you're engaging in tremendous amounts of deficit spending, as you suggest, Adam, you are basically printing and spending. And if you print and spend, that's going to be stimulative to the economy. And if you are stimulating beyond the capacity of the economy to produce, then you get inflation, which is part of the story of what happened over the couple of years. The US deficit is projected to be at least 5% forever going forward. So that's going to be, I think, quite inflationary. That's something that we've actually seen throughout history, and we see across the world as well. It's a very reliable sign, a very reliable indicator of inflationary pressures.
No, I agree. And just if you had any more insight, because I know you're brilliant on these topics, with the monetary plumbing of issuing so much debt, I was looking at, you know, overnight reverse repo's been bleeding out. They ended the BTFP, Fed's rolling off its balance sheet. I'm assuming they'll probably taper that, I'd imagine. If the Treasury keeps issuing bonds and the banks have to start, would they essentially be diverting their reserves then, if these other pools are gone to pull from, to absorb that? And do you think that would, if so, would it create any problems in the banking sector?
So reverse repo is like a pool of liquidity that right now is, you know, being drawn to fund repo, basically. So what you have right now is you have a lot of institutional investors like hedge funds who are borrowing in repo to buy treasuries as part of a basis trade. Now, going forward, we issue a lot of treasuries. I think there is a possibility that, a good chance that the market will have trouble digesting all of this stuff, simply because the market's not as elastic as it used to be because of regulations that were designed to make the banking system safer. Now, the good news is that there's obviously very easy solutions to this. One of them is to just to toggle the regulations a bit and to encourage banks to buy more treasuries. I think you hint at this. Now, banks historically in the US don't actually own a lot of treasuries. They do much better owning other stuff, be it loans or be it mortgages. But banks are different from most other investors in that they're highly regulated. And so whenever they make an investment, they have to take that into account. You can definitely tweak the regs, and there's some discussion of this to make it more attractive to them to buy treasuries. And if that's the case, you have another source of demand. But at the end of the day, if the treasury market becomes disorderly, you can always have the Fed buy it. And that's certainly what we saw in the UK when we had some volatility in the gilt market last year, or maybe 2 years ago, I forget. So anyway, the Bank of England just came and they stabilized it. So this is something that can be solved, but it is definitely a source of volatility. And I do think that there is a good chance we would have some more, I think, surprises there. Yeah.
We've also seen that in Japan too, right? With the BOJ buying finance ministry debt as well. I mean, it just has become a feature with a lot of this activity with mature countries, mature economies.
Yeah, maybe one day the Fed
love it or hate it
form of yield curve control like Japan. It wouldn't be the first time. In World War II, Fed had yield curve control as well, right? So these are tools that the central banks know how to use. And if worse comes to worse, they could always roll them out.
Yeah. By the way, Joseph, I've said this before, but I actually think it's very easy for people to criticize the Fed. I actually think, given the challenge they've had over the past 4 or 5 years, they've actually done a very good job, I think, of managing things. I don't love the inflationary environment, but given all of the things that they've had coming at them, I actually think they've done a pretty good job at it. And it's really hard to suggest a path that they could have done differently to navigate both the kind of the markets, the economy, and the politics associated with the environment that they've had. I want to talk a little bit about QT. You've kind of gone there a little bit, but you posted a comment on QT earlier this week, looking at, you say the Fed securities today are about $7 trillion after imminent taper. QT looks to be about $45 billion a month. So, and you say that will run for about 1 to 2 years, and then Q will likely move into some sort of QE. So can you talk us through that? Why would that run for 2 years and then reverse? And is it possible that that could accelerate, because that drains money out of the market, right? Which could potentially be a disinflationary catalyst.
So the Fed has been doing QT for almost 2 years. So they've been doing it at a maximum rate of about $95 billion a month. Now, it looks like they are strongly suggesting that next month they will begin to taper it, and it will go probably at a maximum. So they're probably going to half their treasury runoff from 60 to 30 billion a month. So that's probably going to lead to about a runoff of about 45 billion a month. Now, they're telling you they want to slow down the pace of runoff because they think that as the reverse repo facility balances become low, they want to be a bit more cautious. One of the things that, so in September of 2019, we saw repo rates kind of spike a bit. And their interpretation of that episode was that they were too aggressive with QT and they want to avoid a repeat of that episode. So second time around, they're saying that, hey, we've done a lot of QT so far, and now that we think that we're getting closer and closer to maybe where we might stop, let's slow down and be a bit more cautious. Now, as they slow down next month, most likely next month, that doesn't necessarily tell you anything about when they're ultimately going to end. So that's an open question. Now, this past week, the Open Markets Desk of the New York Fed put out their annual report. And in that annual report, they have projections as to where, you know, potentially the Fed could end. Now, to be clear, the Open Markets Desk in making this report doesn't have any special insight of the future. And it's not some kind of document that's intended to communicate the Fed's plan. It's just their best guess. So their best guess is in this scenario, let's say we could do QT for another 1 to 2 years. So they could say that, yeah, maybe we can do QT. Maybe we'll stop sometime in late 2025. So I think all things equal, this is positive for the market, right? So again, slowing down QT, private sector has less treasuries it needs to digest. Again, the drain of liquidity slows down a little bit from the banking sector. But it's really hard to know when the ultimate QT will stop. I imagine what would happen is that we get some kind of economic slowdown. The Fed cuts rates, shifts to easy mode, and naturally stops QT as well.
So we have a floor, it looks like. The expected floor is about $6 trillion. We'll just keep that on the balance sheet.
Yeah, that's how it works now. So after the great financial, so before the GFC, before 2008, the Fed had a pretty small balance sheet. It had what you call a scarce reserve regime. Afterwards, the whole framework changed. The Fed has a big balance sheet now. Why? It's because they think that, okay, so once upon a time, if you're a bank, right, where do you keep your cash? You'd keep your cash actually at another bank. It's called the federal funds rate. So banks obviously need cash to meet redemptions, withdrawals from clients, and so forth. Now, the bank used to keep their cash at another bank, which totally works and worked for hundreds of years, except that when you have credit risk in the banking system, then, you know, maybe one bank, you know, deposited at another bank, that bank fails, then this bank can't meet its redemptions, and then everyone fails. You have this huge daisy chain effect. After the great financial crises, banks all keep their cash at the Fed. Now, because everyone keeps their cash at the Fed and these balances are called reserves, Fed naturally needs to have a bigger balance sheet because now they are the where all the banks store their liquidity.
Okay, so that $6 trillion isn't just kind of laziness holding MBS or something like that. It's, you know, it's banks actually putting their deposits in the Fed for short-term periods. Is that the right read?
Well, they need cash. Well, banks need cash, right? After all, when you go and you withdraw cash from the bank or make payments on behalf of you, they need cash. So yeah, they structurally need a larger balance sheet. It's just a fundamental change in how the banking system operates pre and post great financial crises.
Joseph, what, you know the Fed better than anyone I know. What are we missing? You know, what are we missing right now that people aren't noticing about what the Fed is or isn't doing?
I think the big trend going forward is that the Fed is probably going to be a less influential in shaping market prices going forward. I think the big structural change in the world is, as I discussed earlier, this fiscal deficit. Now, Fed obviously has a money printer, but Congress does as well. They print treasury securities, which are money-like assets. Now, they're printing a lot, and they expect to be printing a lot going forward. And as they become more prominent, I think the Fed is going to become less prominent in shaping economic conditions and market pricing.
How much of that is a legacy? I remember 10 years ago when Yellen, as Fed chair, was begging for fiscal. And, you know, she was saying, look, there's no fiscal coming. This is all monetary policy. We have to have some fiscal. Now that she's Treasury Secretary, I mean, she's set some really interesting strategies and, you know, in what the Treasury is doing. How much of what you're talking about the go forward path is because of Yellen's absence of fiscal as she was the Fed chair? Do you think that's a legacy of that era?
Yeah, Tony, I think that's exactly right. So oftentimes, so in the 2008 financial crisis, afterwards, it led to what we call the Great Recession, where growth was slow, unemployment was high for an extended period of time. And I think what we learned from that episode is that, you know, we could have done more fiscal. That would have been very helpful. Now, 2020 comes along, we take that lesson into account, we spend tremendous amounts of money. And, economy, V-shaped recovery and everything is fine. But then again, we're forgetting the lessons that we learned in the 1980s and 70s. And basically what all governments knew for hundreds of years before is that when you spend a lot of money, well, you get inflation. And it's very difficult to stop because it's very politically unpopular. You need to, when you stop spending all that money, you get a recession and you get voted out of office. So we are on a pathway that is well-trodden and has been seen over and over again throughout history. And it usually doesn't end well, but it can be quite good for asset prices.
That's good. Thanks for that, Joseph.
Tony, go ahead. Do you mind if I comment?
Absolutely, yeah.
I think also the structure of the economy, like how GDP is in the U.S., like consumption, investment, net exports, government. I think that matters too for our fiscal deficit because I think Japan's had their 230% debt to GDP, huge fiscal supply, and they've couldn't get inflation going for almost three decades at that time until it took a supply shock, and I think it just showed that the government, well, the banking system in Japan too, they had rates at zero, negative and quantitative easing, but they couldn't force people to borrow. And I think that was a lot of problem with the Fed too, is that you can't, if households don't want to borrow, take out the debt, the money, the credit isn't created. And I think with the Treasury after COVID, it was like, hey, now the government's going to directly put this money in your bank account, or we're going to forgive loans, PPP yep. loans, et cetera. And I think, that was a huge structural change because it literally actually forced it. It was like a liability-free net asset into the private sector. And I think that's the playbook they're probably going to keep doing going forward, just as usually they go back to what kind of worked previously. So I am curious how that's going to play out, but I do think it will probably have some repercussions on the economy.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the PPP and the direct transfers post-COVID and during COVID, I think it really changed the expectations for a generation. And we're going to have that with us for at least the next decade in terms of those expectations. Does that make sense to you, Joseph?
Absolutely. I mean, I opened the news and Biden's forgiving student loans, Biden's giving money to buy new homes and so forth. You're shaping an expectation that people are going to expect more and more free things. Now, that really fundamentally tilts the risk towards more inflation and higher asset prices, because we know the reaction function is going to be, let's just spend more money. After all, it's not my money. We can just print it.
Yeah, moral hazard. Yeah, I was actually talking with someone about that recently. I said, with house prices, how they are, the car price, I mean, they're just extending out loans now, lower down payments. You can do all these things, but when you're taking out credit is demand, right? You go to a bank, you're like, I'm going to buy a car, we'll give you a loan. You're purchasing something. That guy goes, takes the money, deposits it. So whatever. So if you get to that capacity where they can't borrow anymore, or the balance sheet is like, hey, my utilization's up, and banks, let's say they don't want to lend, or they're just getting skittish. That does become a problem, because I don't see how anyone would be able to afford an auto, not anyone, I shouldn't generalize it, but you get the point, like a home, an auto loan, student loan. So then the government comes in and says, hey, we will subsidize it, back the loans, et cetera. I mean, they don't do that in auto, but it kind of puts a floor in, because otherwise I would imagine prices would have to collapse to the point that people with wage growth alone could afford it if they didn't take out credit. And I don't think the auto companies, the lobby groups would want that to happen. Obviously, you see their margins get crushed, or anyone who's holding the bag. So I don't know if I said something incorrect there, but that's kind of how I look at it. And I think
here's the only incorrect thing you said, Adam. They don't do it in auto yet.
Yeah, I think we're going to see more and more of the government doing these kind of things, just because they got to keep prices from collapsing, because you're going to piss off one group of people, and then, so forth.
Yeah, it's we're in new territory. I think it's, as Joseph said about more fiscal, I think we're just going to have to see what happens over the next few years. We're going to have to see what happens with the election in November and what happens going into 25, to see in terms of continuity. And just because we have a change of parties doesn't necessarily mean that this is going to change. Right, because the Republicans have not been more fiscally responsible than the Democrats. So there's the brand, but then there's the reality of things. And so I don't know that a change of party, I'm not saying it won't, but I'm not convinced that a change of party will necessarily change the trajectory.
I agree. So they're both constrained.
Yeah, absolutely. Speaking of central planning, let's talk about China for a minute. Adam, you talked a little bit about Chinese exports this week, and it's pretty bleak. Since you said that, there's been a chorus of people worried about China overproducing and dumping goods on global markets. Can you tell us what that looks like? Kind of what products or areas would you expect that to happen? How quickly could that happen? What would happen to the CNY, or what would need to happen to CNY? I'm just really curious if, you know, if China is turning to exports as a vehicle of growth, which is a 40-year-old story for China, if they're turning back in that direction, to be honest, to me, it looks like they're stepping backward. But what does that scenario look like to you?
So, yeah, you and I think almost a year ago, we were talking about the auto sector that was just, it was just getting out of control with Chinese exports, and they overproduce cars. I think 2.5 cars and produced per one consumed in their economy. Now solar panels is a big one. They're just dumping solar panels everywhere. I mean, I think them alone outpaced global installation by what, 220%, just China. And it's flooding into the Netherlands, it's flooding into Germany and Europe. Now the US imports of solar panels have surged. You know, Brussels now is trying to do tariffs and et cetera, quotas. They're saying the companies are saying it's not enough. I think Longi Green Technology in China, it's a major player. They just had to lay off a good amount of their workforce because, you know, the margins are getting crushed at this point because there's just too much supply. And China just, they got to figure out where to put it. They've been ramping up on manufactured investment. There's a good chart from the Atlantic Council, and they had posted a thing as the property investment in China year over year has plunged. It just nosedove. The other side was manufacturing suddenly ramped up to like offset it, because otherwise, if both were down, you would have slower growth domestically in China, especially with their consumer on the relatively weak side. China also has an excessively high savings rate, and they don't really have any social benefits or systems in their economy to promote consumption. And that's kind of been the talk last year. Now we've seen them saying, okay, is China going to do targeted fiscal stimulus? And it looks like they're doing some, and it looks like they're going to hit a bigger, I wouldn't say fiscal deficit, but they're starting to crank it up. But I think they are more keen towards a manufacturing rebound. But the problem is they're too big to export their way out of this problem. Like, the scale wise, it's the second largest economy in the world by a wide margin. It's not as if Russia or Japan suddenly were trying to export their way into higher growth, or Brazil. I mean, when China does it, everyone's going to feel it. And I also think it's important because Chinese exports is now pissing off Brazil. Brazil has come out and everyone was saying, oh, you know, yuanization or de-dollarization with Brazil's joining with China. Just 2 weeks ago, Brazil Foreign Trade Ministry basically set up tariffs. They're looking at the probing of major sectors because China's just dumping goods into their economy, and they don't want them because it crowds out their own manufacturing capacity. Now you know it's probably going to restart trade wars in the U.S. Obviously, the Biden's now talking about steel. There's pictures of tons of steel that they're not using in China because they bought all of it. Where does it go? They're trying to dump it onto global markets now. You know, Joe Biden's even talking about, you know, steel tariffs, solar panels, and the EVs flooding into Germany and Europe. Well, Germany's a big auto producer, right? I don't think they would be very happy about getting their manufacturing crowded out to subsidize Chinese growth. And I think that's the problem with China now, is that they're trying to eke out their own growth, and, you know, which they have a lot of structural problems in their economy, but they need to keep the growth rate generally going somewhere relative to their debt, that they're trying to dump it and put them on the rest of the world. And the rest of the world now is starting to, you know, tariffs, quotas, etc. And I think it's interesting because after the Great Depression had started, or right at the beginning, they kind of went down this trade war route. A lot of countries started, you know, putting tariffs on each other, because the idea was back then, hey, we don't want your goods coming in, very protectionist. We don't want your goods coming in. We want to produce and sell. And then that next country would be like, all right, well, we're not going to do that. You put a tariff on us, we're putting one on you. And then I think it was the Smoot-Hawley Act, actually. And then they just, everything, it just kicked off everybody putting trade tariffs and barriers on each other. And it just, you know, it became a big problem for global growth in every economy, because whatever they couldn't consume at home, they were trying to dump abroad and they couldn't get it out. So unemployment had to go up. And yeah, I think that's the problem.
I remember in 2017 when a guy started putting tariffs on Chinese steel and other goods, and people said, adding tariffs and anti-dumping is not the way to do things. We just don't do that anymore. And now we have Brazil, Europe, the Biden administration, and other guys all saying that tariffs are the answer and anti-dumping is the answer. So, you know, it's strange that kind of 7, 8 years ago, people said, we need to accept this because it puts the American consumer in a better position. If China overproduces, it puts us in a better position because we can afford more. But now, now we're hearing all these countries that criticized a guy 7, 8 years ago, and a president who was very much on the other side of the guy 7, 8 years ago, now doing the same thing, right? And so does China overproducing not put the U.S. consumer in a better position? Does it or does it not? I mean, we need to look at these arguments consistently.
It's a good point. There's a pro and a con to it. Like everything, it's always a double-edged sword. Yes, manufactured goods, for instance, solar panels per kilowatt, I think it's down like 90% in the last few years. So anyone getting solar panels, great. As a consumer, it's like, this is awesome. I can get solar panels much cheaper, etc. So that's always good, having the supply. But I think with what China's doing is that they're operating at huge losses. That's the problem with China. They're just trying to get the growth going. And by them subsidizing, the Chinese government subsidizes the hell out of their manufacturing sector, is that it's flooding out as that overcapacity to prevent unemployment at home. Because otherwise those businesses would have to have, they would lay everybody off, they go bankrupt, etc. Whoever lent to them's on the hook, and so forth. Yeah. So as it comes into these economies, yes, we can have the deflation from it, but then at the same time, how long will it take until that deflation here prices out? You know, like we saw Tesla. Now, let's just use them. They couldn't, their sales drop. China's now overproducing EVs, so they're not consuming as much Tesla vehicles because they're producing so much at home that they're even trying to get theirs out, which is crowding out Tesla's margins in other or markets. And then Tesla has laying off employees, even though that in Buffalo this week. So that's the problem. And then once you have the people start getting unemployed here, I think that will overwhelm the political picture, then prices being down and manufactured goods when you have, you know, a million get laid off.
But again, the argument 7, 8 years ago was Chinese subsidies eventually help U.S. consumers. And we're hearing the same people today say just the opposite. And so I just, for consistency of reasoning, I'm not accusing you of doing this, Adam, but I'm just saying that in the political environment, we have to have consistency of reasoning. Do Chinese subsidies help U.S. consumers, or do they not help U.S. consumers? Do we look at this in a kind of GATT trade environment, which I say again and again to people, the average tariff globally is 2.4%. That's from the World Bank. Okay. It's not huge. Tariffs are not huge. They're not a huge drag on the world economy. And so when we put things at, say, 25%, that's raising tariffs by 10 times on, say, steel or something like that. Right. And so that is a drag on that. And, you know, I think, again, we just want to be intellectually honest and be consistent with, you know, with the reasoning. Now, when we look at Japan, I assume that on some level, if China wants to sell these overproduced goods, they're going to have to devalue their currency, which they have been over the last few months, right? We also look at JPY, which has been devalued to what, 154, 155 right now, something like that. And that tells me on some level that Japan is trying to be export competitive. Maybe that's not the prime reason, but, you know, they're trying to be somewhat export competitive with their goods on a devalued JPY. So if we have China and Japan doing it, Korea is going to have to do it too, right? So, and Northeast Asia produces what, 40% of all manufactured goods globally or something. So if we have currency deval in Northeast Asia, that creates a huge consumption opportunity for the West and really helps to bring down inflation. Is that, am I being kind of unreasonable in my assessment?
No, that's true. And like we were saying earlier, after the Great Depression, it started with the currency war, similar, everyone trying to underpeg each other. And then it went to tariffs and trade war because, you know, it just spiraled out of control. And I do think how I would put it is for the consistency, because I agree with you and politicians, you know, I wouldn't, you know, put too much faith in what they say, just pandering. But I think if you look at U.S. manufacturing sector prior to this year or last couple of years had been dying since the 1980s. And so if you were in manufacturing, obviously those imports from abroad weren't great for you. But if you were someone who wasn't in manufacturing, you're in the service sector, then it was good for you. And I think that's where it's always going to be a double-edged sword. And I guess whatever lobby group, you know, auto is a big one in the U.S. So I think if China wants to keep flooding EVs all over, I think that's going to really take it to the next level. But I think you're right with Japan. Japan's like, I think it was their GDP, one GDP report ago. It basically, all their growth came from exports. It was essentially 90% of it was from the exports. And they were saying the cheaper yen. And I think it's mainly because the spread difference between the U.S. rates and like Japan is hurting it. But with China's cutting interest rates while the U.S. is raising them. And it's put pressure on the yuan. And I do, but it has helped their exports. It's made it more competitive. But on the flip side, it's also made their imports more costly. And with Japan, right, it's not as big of a deal because Japan's a smaller economy. Like we were saying, if they want to try to grow their way out, that's not going to unbalance the global system. I mean, it's not the 1980s where Japan was, you know, really coming in hot right up on the, West Germany and Japan behind the U.S. But now China's just way too big. If they reduce their imports relative to exports, which is what we've seen, their imports have been terrible. That's a huge drag on global growth, right? Because all these economies, I mean, that was the whole thesis we heard about China. It's like, oh, they're going to have the middle class that's going to consume and, you know,
they've been saying it for 30 years.
Yeah. And that's the problem, that their current account surplus is bigger now than before 10 years ago. And I think that's the problem, is that they are just not net consuming and now they're actually net producing, and it's going to force the rest of the world to absorb it.
Tracy, can you come in here? You know, Adam's talking about, say, EVs, solar cells and that sort of thing. And we've talked before about the difficulties that operating companies are having with, say, windmills and solar and that sort of thing. And if those parts are cheaper, the operation is still relatively expensive, right? So will the, say, necessarily the cheaper solar cells or wind parts, will that make a big dent on the ability of these operating companies to operate these solar farms and wind farms?
Not if you're talking these large scale projects. Obviously, that's going to make it much easier for, say, the residential customer that wants to put solar panels on the roof. And of course, that's going to be, you know, that's going to be great for them. But if we're talking about these large scale commercial projects, we're still in a non-NARP ZERP environment. And so those projects still require a lot of financing, no matter how cheap the parts are. There's a lot more involved than just the parts. And so, you know, again, this goes back to, and we've discussed this before, Tony, where, you know, I said, literally these projects are becoming more difficult since we are not in a NERP ZERP environment again. Yeah.
And in terms of EVs, so it sounds to me like what Adam is saying is China's really looking at, say, green equipment and EVs to, you know, support their export-driven economy. But we've seen a drop-off in EV adoption of late. Is that right? Or am I misreading that?
Well, particularly in the United States, yeah, we are seeing that. But we have to remember that we don't import Chinese EVs, right? Their major export market is Europe, is the biggest market in the West. And so, you know, and we have seen somewhat of a drop off there as well, you know, not as big as the United States, but, you know, we're a very big country. And so the logistics don't work the same here. Plus, we don't have the infrastructure build out. But yeah, absolutely. You know, if you look at the top 20 EV companies, 16 of them are Chinese globally. So, you know, they have saturated that market. That is their market. They are counting on that. You know, of course, they're going to try to sell those in Africa, South America, Europe, and
Where grids are very not great, right?
right. So that's gonna be a
Mm-hmm.
problem. I mean, Europe's their best market right now, just because of the fact that they have more infrastructure built out, and you're talking about much smaller countries, generally
Yep.
speaking.
So, Adam, the other side of this that you talk about is the consumption in markets. And you posted something about Japan, say the average monthly consumption expenditure per household was up 2.8% in nominal terms, but down 0.5% in real terms. So, as these countries are devaluing or depreciating their currency, domestic consumption, it's a lot harder for those consumers to meet their needs, right?
Yeah, and there's actually a good so a lot of the predominant school of thought is that when you want to boost exports, you cut your interest rate. I'm sorry, you cut your currency, devalue it. But there's some good literature that actually says it's not really about the exports, it's the imports relative to the exports. Because if you export the same amount but your imports drop, you bring in more money. You will run a current account surplus. And they're saying that's the main thing is that when instead of cutting the currency to boost exports, you're doing it to curb imports, which will increase your the state coffers essentially, or the margins for the whoever the on the government side. And that's the problem with Japan right now is that Japan doesn't have a strong consumer. I mean, they haven't had one really ever. That was, 1991. They were all in it. They were kind of what China is today. They were a booming export economy. I think 15% of global exports as a percentage of GDP were coming from Japan alone before the Plaza Accord in 86. And then it dropped down to 8% by 91. But also the US essentially forced Japan and West Germany to let their currencies appreciate. So their demand side started increasing, debt started increasing their economies, mainly because the BOJ, to offset that, the loss of export productivity or exports, they cranked interest rates down very low to try to keep growth going at home and not being stuck in a deflationary trap from such a rapidly appreciating currency. And you saw household debt balloon. You saw obviously the real estate market was hot and the banks, everything blew up. And I think that's what China is now trying. They're talking about doing is now they're just doubling down on what got them here in the past. You can only build so many ghost cities, and those take a ton of commodities. And I mean, think how this is going to affect Australia, Brazil, et cetera. Like, there's so many iron ore, copper, et cetera, that's going into China and smelting, and it's not going to be used. And
Well, these guys have been
all
struggling with. I've worked with a lot of mining firms over the years, like not as customers, not, I didn't work for them, but they've struggled for the last, say, 10 or 15 years. Their big question is, where is the next China? Right? They're trying to
Yeah.
figure out where is the next China? There isn't another China. This is a gener that was a generational opportunity. It's not coming again.
The only one of scale, it would have to be India. In India, it runs a current account deficit. It's a big
Different.
one. Yeah. It's a
Different. Very different.
No, it is.
Very
It's
hard.
very different. I completely agree with you. It's totally different. I just mean potentially scale-wise, it's the only one I would imagine that could replicate China. But then you have the same problem. If India goes the same route as China and Japan and Brazil and Scandinavia did back in the day to boost exports. If they go all in on infrastructure and manufacturing, then you're just going to have everyone focusing on manufacturing. And where's the demand from? And Michael Pettis does a lot of good work on this. He shows that like global issues today is under consumption. The US is essentially carrying the entire economy because we're the net consumer. We consume over $1 trillion worth of excess. If we weren't consuming this much or we balanced our budget, that's $1 trillion from abroad that goes nowhere. And then you'd have layoff, unemployment in those economies. And that's kind of the problem.
Modi's been trying to get Make in India going for a decade now, and I mean, it's got some traction, but not a huge amount of traction. Hey, Joseph, I want to understand a little bit about the yen and with the struggles that the BOJ has had to keep the yen from falling through, you know, whatever, 155, 160. There are swap lines in place between the Fed and BOJ, is that right? And so how could they potentially use those to keep the yen from falling further?
So the yen has been depreciating significantly. And as Adam noted, a lot of it seems to be due to the interest rate differentials. So here in the US, short-term interest rates, about 5.5. At Japan, they raised their interest rates the first time in decades from negative 0.1 to zero. So still 0 to 5.5%. That's a big gap. So it seems like there's a lot of investors in Japan. You know, why don't we just go buy assets abroad? So if you buy fixed income in the US, you get a higher interest rate, or you can even buy equities. You can make a double play, right? Equities go up and you also make money on the currency. So in order to stop this depreciation, there's usually three things that policymakers do. First, of course, is to do a lot of jawboning. And we've seen that over and over again.
A lot. I think,
yeah. And it looks like it's not working. So
UN right now, doesn't have the credibility that, you know, that they've had in the past for some reason.
You got to put up or shut up, right?
Right, exactly. Yep.
So they did intervene. Okay. So the next step, of course, is to intervene. So what you would do is you would basically, you know, take your foreign currency, take dollars, sell dollars and buy yen. They did that, I believe, 2 years ago, fourth quarter of 2 years ago. So that actually did have an impact. That sent a strong signal, and we saw the yen strengthen. But again, it just re-weakened because the interest rate differentials are so large. Now, they have a lot of money. They have about $1 trillion worth of foreign reserves. Not all of that is in U.S. dollars, but still, Japan, as we all know, is a big exporting nation. They've accumulated a lot of foreign currency. They can definitely support their currency. But the thing is, you know, it's just a waste because you only buy time. Mm-hmm. The third thing they can do is the big guns, and that's actually to raise interest rates there significantly, such that the interest rate differential between the U.S. and, you know, Eurozone, everyone else, and Japan is narrower. But that has big impacts on their own economy as well, so they're not going to do that. So they do seem to be in a pretty hard place right now. So one thing I will note, though, since you guys were talking about the possibility of tariffs and so forth, you know, there's an article from Politico citing that, you know, Trump trade advisors are talking about a dollar devaluation. So they're kind of reopening the playbook of once upon a time, right? So tariffs plus dollar devaluation boost U.S. export industry, create jobs and so forth. So, you know, maybe that could happen in a Trump administration. Maybe that will save the yen. There's a lot of when you're
careful
going
what you wish for.
when you're going into this space, it's a lot of politics involved. It's really difficult to predict. And honestly, if we hope our policymakers are reasonable and have logically consistency, we're going to be disappointed.
Yeah, I think it was Lighthizer who was talking about that, and he's a lawyer. I mean, I understand the, you know, potential theory underneath it, but I think these type of policies tend to overshoot. So we just have to be really careful if that's the path we're going down. Adam, what do you think about that dollar deval? You think it's potential possibility?
I think if, as a reserve currency, you know, what is it? Triffin's dilemma, right? You have to have a perpetual deficit because any country, you are the reserve currency. Everyone, how are they going to get the dollars they need to import from around the world unless you're running a deficit net dollars? Which there's clearly huge demand for. For the U.S. to devalue, it would devalue its relative, right? I don't think China, who's also a huge exporter, or Japan, would sit idly, or Europe too, actually. They run a huge current account surplus since the pig implosion. I don't think they would sit idly by and let the U.S. devalue against their currencies, right, to steal their market share, and then they would probably go back, and then I think that would make consumption just a huge problem, under consumption in the world, especially when demographics are starting to look kind of shaky. You know, the last thing you want is volatility for retiree, anyone over 65, right, because that could definitely impact their spending patterns or their investment patterns. So that, you know, and then a ripple to pension funds and etc.
Yeah, and EURUSD is sitting in about 106 right now. I mean, that's probably a little overvalued USD. I think that's probably a little over where we want to be. But seeing a major devaluation just seems, I don't know, a little bit naive and unnecessary. So,
Yeah, you would have to see another currency really step up. I mean, the euro was there after 08, right? Like it was the dollar, Dixie dropped one in the 60s. The euro was extremely high and Canadian dollar. But then, of course, then that imploded, helped implode their economies. And now I just don't see another economy that has the growth potential, especially with China now flatlining, that would essentially make a big counter to the dollar.
It's really hard. Well, there's always the BRICS currency, right? So, okay, good. Let's move on to energy. Tracy, you put up a tweet earlier this week talking about hedge funds dumping energy stocks and buying crude oil futures. It's
Options.
interesting. Sorry, options. I'm
You're
sorry.
even worse.
Right. Crude oil options. I'm sorry about that. Yeah, tell us about that. Why are they doing that? It seems obviously speculative, and especially where
Speculative.
oil. Yeah, tell us about that.
That's an understatement. First of all, it's straight up gambling. I mean, and somebody said, well, they're like, well, it's just like investing in physical gold. And I was like, well, no, wait a minute. This is, first of all, it's paper barrels, and then it's options on paper barrels. So you're talking a derivative of a derivative. This isn't even close to owning anything in the physical market, right? These are financially settled products. And if you want to invest in physical oil, then you invest in an E&P company. That's what you do. And so I, for me, this sounds like, I don't know, maybe they're closing out. This sounds like gambling to me. I just don't have any other, and I kind of made a crazy face on it because I was like, why would you dump an investment that is doing well
And generating cash.
to literally throw it on, red number nine?
Right.
And since this information came out, we're down $6. And these guys were, these option strikes that they were betting on are, pretty high strikes. Now, granted, we don't know if where they're just selling, say they're selling $100 call or they're actually buying $100 call. Either way, it's gambling.
Right. So is it demand or geopolitical risk, or what went into, you think went into their calculation to sell operating companies and move into commodity options?
Well, I that is a very good question, and I wish I could talk to some people and ask them why. Because, the people that I talk to that run energy-only hedge funds are also scratching their heads. Why would you do that? And these are the hedge funds that are doing this are, hedge funds that are broad-based hedge funds. They're not solely because
Not experts.
All of the people that, because I immediately got on the phone with everybody I know that actually ran at oil and gas only hedge fund, and they were like, what? So,
Right. So first, I'm going to plug Tracy. Anybody needs advice on their hedge fund strategy for energy, contact Tracy. She's amazing. She knows everything there is to know. So that's the first plug. But second of all, that just seems to me like there is a huge expectation of risk. They're just accepting so much risk by doing that. And it seems to me like they're expecting a huge escalation of tensions in the Middle East or something.
Well, obviously, I mean, obviously they're thinking geopolitical risk, but I think that to do that suddenly, it's just not. I just really can't wrap my head around the reasoning for that, to be honest with you. I think it's haphazard, and I think it's you're kind of doing a disservice to your clients, in my opinion.
Right. So today's Friday. So we just had this Israel Iran, tit for tat last night and last weekend and other things. And crude's up 1% today. Right. So it almost feels like, and you've said this before, Tracy, we're kind of in a range for a period. So I don't know over what period we break out of that. But it just feels like there's a we're necessarily and purposely in a range. So I'm trying to understand why people would put, $100 calls out there.
I think that we keep ratcheting higher, right? I mean, we spent months at, the lower 70s, then we spent months at, the mid 70s, then we spent a few weeks at the mid 80s. Now we're kind of consolidating in that mid 80 zone, and I'm talking about Brent here, a little bit lower for WTI. Obviously if you're rolling the dice on this, and again, I don't know how far out they have their options. Are they 2025? Are they 2026? Because when you look at the CFTC COT, they take the total across every expiration. They don't break it down to every expiration. So I don't know. Are they looking at this year, next year, 2026, 2027? We don't really know. That's where some of the information we get is a little bit opaque. But that said, that's a big bet, right? So they're counting on something, and it might not just be near-term political, geopolitical issues. This could be, that decision could be result of a lot of things, depending on how far out you are in your strike price.
I know this sounds a little bit elementary, Tracy, and I'm sorry, but I think I just want to understand the risk associated with investing in, say, E&P companies versus risking directly in crude options. How much more risk are you accepting by investing in options? Is it
Well,
3 times, 10 times? I mean, I know there's no perfect number, but is it a magnitude or, how does that work?
yeah, it's absolutely, especially when you have oil prices as volatile as they have been, then that's a huge risk because when are you gonna, what's your stop? When you get out, how much volatility do you want to accept in your risk portfolio, right? One day you could be down $1 million, the next day you could be up $1 million. You have no idea. So it's a huge risk to be taking in a portfolio where you're supposed to be an investment, right? Again, so it would seem that if I think oil prices are going higher, I'm going to invest in E&P companies. That way, I actually own physical barrels because those companies own physical barrels and I have a piece of that rather than, again, trying to gamble on some sort of option strategy. And there are funds that we know that have blown up over and over again that
A
have used
lot.
strategy before. And so I just really can't wrap my head around it, but because I think I just don't really I just don't understand. I wish I could get inside these people's heads and say, this is what I'm going to do with my investors' money. I'm going to, gamble it on Brent crude options.
Adam, by definition, say a hedge fund is there partly to hedge risk. So, what do you think about this?
I think it's God knows what they're all doing, weapons of mass destruction or financial destruction. I think it's a quick way to really blow up. I think you've seen it, especially when you're supplying with options, sp selling options, naked options. And I don't really I don't know. I don't know what they're really thinking. I think geopolitically, Iran's definitely a big player in oil, or becoming a bigger oil. They're ramping up production because they're not under the OPEC quotas. But I think the US's growth has outpaced it. I don't know where a huge amount of gasoline demand suddenly going to come from. It looks like it's kind of already tapered off in China. So I do think the mid 80 range is kind of what they're going to want to keep it at. And I know there's been some issues with Ukraine targeting Russian refineries. I think that that was a thing recently. And I do think that Iran and Israel are gearing up. That whole region is just a powder keg, and God knows how it's going to happen going forward.
Well, and diesel and jet fuel are definitely very tight.
Yeah.
But I this straight crude seems a little bit interesting. So let's move on to the kind of final topic, the UAE not cloud seeding floods that happened. We keep hearing that it's definitely not cloud seeding. There's no way it could be cloud seeding. It's just definitely not cloud seeding. But Tracy, you talked about the crude in Kazakhstan and some potential impact that production setbacks that could happen in Kazakhstan and maybe throughout the region because of that activity. Can you talk us through, like, is this a major disruption or is this something that's fairly temporary?
These are two separate issues, right? So UAE, this did not affect any sort of oil production whatsoever, which is
Oh, by the way, it definitely wasn't cloud seeding.
very outside of the cities, which is where we saw the major rainfall, right? And so there is no production disruption as far as their production is concerned. Now, when we go to Kazakhstan, they had that the problem with that is they had a dam that broke in Russia that crossed over the water crossed over the border. This because this is region's like a small oil producing region, literally on the Kazakhstan-Russian border. So you had they had a snow melt, a quick snow melt, which kind of started the flooding, and then we had a dam that broke in Russia that flooded into Kazakhstan. And so that was kind of the problem in that region. So they're kind of two totally different kind
Okay.
events that
But
happened.
in terms of disruption from either the UAE stuff or Kazakhstan, do you see that as a major disruption for crude production or is it kind of at the edges?
At the edges.
Okay.
I don't think it's a big deal. I mean, it's a big deal for Kazakhstan. That's certainly going to, hurt their oil production and the monies they bring in from that oil production. And we'll have to see how long that is offline and, what it's going to take, if there's any damage and how long that's going to take, et cetera. So it's more of a, Kazakhstan's not really a huge producer. So it more affects their country and their income more than I would say global production in total.
Great. Guys, thank you so much. We've been around the world and back today. I am so grateful for the contributions you've made and thoughts you've had. So I really appreciate this. Have a great weekend and have a great week ahead. Thank you, guys.
Thanks.
Thanks, Tony.